Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Elliot Callan, CEO of Prosperity Financial Group, and I'd like to welcome you to a very exciting episode of Meet the Expert. Today is a little bit different. It's for the investor. It's understanding how to invest in themes, and we, as a financial planning and investment advisory firm, do that every day of the week with portfolios. We pick themes, kind of like choosing with Wayne Gretzky where the puck is going instead of where it's been. We want to be in front of the puck so we can get there that much faster and score more goals on behalf of our clients. Scott, I want to get your pronunciation right. Helfstein, is that right?
Right.
Helfstein. He is with Global X. Global X is a $40+ billion money management firm in Midtown Manhattan. He's got a really interesting background. He's with 6 years as a West Point professor. I'm not sure he's the professor you'd want to have, or is he the professor everybody tries to avoid, but he can explain that on his own. And then he's got a PhD in public policy and politics from Michigan. You guys had a great weekend over in Michigan. Congratulations over Ohio State. Blue. Yep. Which puts you, I think, as number two in the country. So by the time everybody airs that, you might be number one after those games. We'll see what happens. But welcome to the show there, Scott.
Thanks for having me, Elliot.
Oh, you're very welcome. So let's talk for a moment. This is for, again, understanding themes of investing. Why is that important? I'm going to ask you that. But for our clients, because when we build portfolios, and we have multiple portfolios that we build for our clients, thematic or theme investing is paramount to our thinking. So why don't we start by just understanding what the heck is thematic investing?
You really set it up perfectly with your introduction, and it's about where the puck is going, not where it's been. Oftentimes we talk about themes as though they are high growth opportunities, and in many cases they might be, but they're not exclusively. When I think about themes, I think about segments of the economy that are truly important to growth in the future, but may not be easily accessible by traditional frameworks, whether it's a growth value type thought process, or even whether it's sub-industry. An example that I frequently use is within sector investing, you have airlines that sit in industrials and hotels that sit in consumer discretionary. During COVID, we learned that those two things were highly correlated, and yet they sit in entirely different sectors. Meanwhile, if you believe cybersecurity, which has 20+ companies that you can invest in, is a significant part of the future of the economy, and I'm happy to talk about why I think that is, but there is really no good way in the traditional framework, sector framework, to invest in it. You can invest in software, in which case you get Microsoft and Adobe and a whole bunch of things that don't really have to do or don't make a lot of money from cybersecurity in and of itself as a unique field. So it's really about, as you said, where the puck is going. And what we can now do, whereas we used to have to pick one or two stocks, keep our fingers crossed, and hope we were really good at that game, the evolution of themes is such that ETFs provide a really good wrapper to select not just one or two, but a whole basket, 20, 30, 40 companies that are tied to an area of future growth and of the future of the economy. And that is really where the puck is going. And so that's how I think about thematic investing. The economy is at point A today. It's moving to point B. And the themes are the things that are going to bridge from one place to the next.
Well, that's great because we love it in our portfolio building. And we're going to talk about a few different themes, including what you just mentioned, cybersecurity, which we are very bullish on. And I want to remind everybody, bullish and bearish. Bullish means we think it's going to grow. Bearish means we're kind of scared about it. It's like going out in the middle of the winter with a light jacket on. You wish you wore a heavier coat because you're getting killed by the cold air. And that's kind of what bearish is. But let me talk for a moment about some of those themes which are so popular. And it seems like the only one that made money this year was the AI, artificial intelligence theme this year. 7 stocks that are touching artificial intelligence. So a few questions about that. One is, why didn't anybody predict that as we went into the year? 2, how come they did so well? And then 3, I've got a few follow-ups. So let me start with those 2.
So let me push back on just 1 right off the bat, which is that AI was tied to the Magnificent 7 or the 7 mega cap stocks. And certainly they had a tremendous year. That said, if we look at, right, there are a couple of different ways to look at indexes. What is printed in the newspaper is the market weight for the index. And that's where the larger the company is, the more that they influence the level of the index, but you can also equal weight these indexes, as you well know. And so what is interesting is that the NASDAQ, which tends to have more growthy stocks than the S&P 500, did outperform, as you would imagine, because of those Magnificent Seven. But the NASDAQ equal weight also outperformed the S&P 500 market cap weight. And so it wasn't just a story of the Magnificent Seven. It's actually been a return to growth investment. So those seven certainly dominated the headlines. But even when we cut them back to be 1% each of a 100 stock index, that index still did really well. And so part of that is because in 2022, quite frankly, many of these growth-oriented themes, including many companies tied to AI, really struggled as interest rates went up. Meanwhile, though, we actually did write a piece this time last year, November of last year, called Entry Points in Burning Buildings, where we actually stressed that themes tied to automation, whether with software like AI or industrial robotics, could do well. And so we've actually seen, by the way, it hasn't been just AI, but more broadly, the way I like to think about it is themes tied to automation have done really, really well. So robotics and artificial intelligence did well. The Internet of Things began recovering. These are the sensors and processors. So we can talk about each of these in more detail. But the theory really starting behind last year was that inflation, particularly really high increases in producer prices, so that's the PPI index, would basically impact the profitability of companies and would force them to cut spending in a lot of these areas. Well, companies, it turns out, have been investing in these automation digitalization technologies during the pandemic, and we're seeing the benefits. And so they managed to operate only passing on half of that inflation to the consumer. So while the consumer was paying at its peak 8.5% higher costs or higher prices year over year, companies were double that. So what we've now seen for 8 straight quarters is that CapEx spending, so this is corporate investment, grown double digits on a year over year basis and has outgrown earnings per share. And so one of the reasons why we've seen AI, but again, I think about it more broadly as automation themes really pull away this year, is because companies are investing in a way that they haven't in the last 20 years. The only people who really invested in the last 20 years were those Magnificent Seven, those mega cap tech companies that you mentioned at the outset. And what we've now seen over the last few years is that the returns or the benefit from corporate investment for everybody else is actually gone up. And for those mega caps, by the way, it's gone down. And so I think it's not just an AI-driven rally. I think AI is an important part of it, hardware, software, and data. But it's really about corporate investment in these automation technologies that drive efficiency for the future.
Right. And I want to remind you, we're talking with Scott Helstein of Global X in Manhattan. And you're listening to Prosperity Financial Group. And that's www.prosperityfinancialgroup.com. Or Elliott, E-L-L-I-O-T, at prosperityfinancialgroup.com, or 925-314-8503. Scott, we're talking about themes and sector investing. People are talking about a recession coming, fourth quarter of 22, fourth quarter of 23, now it's fourth quarter of 24. Interest rates may be peaking, maybe not. There's a lot happening out there. Is it too late to be into sector investing?
If we're going to focus a little bit more narrowly than sectors on themes, I think it's actually still a great market for that. As I mentioned a couple minutes ago, we were more bullish than most people to start 2022, precisely for the reason that you just mentioned. We have now kicked out our estimates for a recession 12 months, 6 months out. And by the way, we are not forecasting that. That is a consensus number that keeps getting pushed out. But what happens is those forecasts keep flattening. So we're not talking about necessarily going to 0% growth. We're now kind of hovering somewhere between 0 and 1. By the time it's all said and done, we might wind up with some slow growth around 1 or 2%. That said, we've also now seen a market that's been driven by earnings growth over the last number of years. So earnings per share over the last 3 years have grown at about 80%. Historically, the 3-year average for earnings growth is 40%. So the gains in the market have actually not been driven by expectations. They've been driven by actual corporate performance. And that tends to shift back and forth. If the Fed is going to kind of peak in its hiking cycle, and similarly, if companies can get back to positive operating leverage, which is when earnings grow faster than sales, we haven't seen that for the last few quarters, but that's the normal condition, then it might well be that investor sentiment shifts in a more positive way towards equities. And as you well know, there's over $6 trillion record cash sitting in money market accounts. And so it doesn't take a lot to nudge that out and to go searching for opportunities in equities. Even more so, I would say, within themes, 2022, a brutal year for investors. They lost money broadly in stocks. They lost money broadly in bonds. But what it also did is hit the reset button on valuations of a lot of the most interesting themes, like industrial automation, like cloud computing, like cybersecurity. So many of these are not necessarily priced to perfection as the way they were 2 years ago. So both, I think, were still a little bit more bullish than consensus across markets. But more importantly, within certain growth areas of the market, we think that there's tremendous opportunity at reasonable prices.
You mentioned that sector investing is different than thematic investing. What's the difference?
So typically, the S&P 500 is broken up into 11 sectors. And so it doesn't work out this way, but that would mean roughly about 50 companies per sector. Again, you have these very broad categories like information technology. Within that, though, there is hardware, which can be semiconductors or can be data storage. There's also software, which can be software service or could be some other type. Similarly, within consumer discretionary, I mentioned before you have hotels and hospitality, but you also have cars. And you also have consumer goods, like sporting goods. So there are these very broad categories of the economy that might work, might not. Whereas in themes, we can actually say, here are 20 companies that make most of their revenue from cybersecurity. Here are 20 companies, 30 companies, whatever it might be, that make their money from defense technology. So you're not getting defense and aerospace, right? You're focused more on the defense area. So it allows us to really target more efficiently, I think, than straight sector investing, which is really a cottage industry of bulge bracket Wall Street strategists, kind of overweighting and underweighting these 11 really broad categories of the economy.
Okay, so you mentioned a few themes here. And if you don't mind me, I'm going to pick your brains on these themes if I could, okay? And we'll talk about the ecosystems and why you like them and why we have them in our portfolios coming into 2024 now and so forth. If I could, and pick your brains a little bit, because our clients are going to pick our brains. And these are good questions. So obviously the number one ecosystem out there is AI. It's in the front page every morning in Fox Business, CNBC. Let's talk about the big AI companies. And did Microsoft finally win? Is Google winning? Who's winning these fights? And should we still be in AI since they had a really good year this year?
So I think it's actually still really early days for AI. And that's one of the reasons why I am not going to go and predict a winner or loser. And that's one of the advantages that ETFs provide, is that it offers a basket. So we don't necessarily need to be heroes. We don't need to pick the right one. We get exposure across the universe. And you mentioned, for example, Microsoft with its partial ownership of OpenAI and ChatGPT seems to have pulled ahead. And yet Google is preparing to release their Gemini software, which is trained on the largest database ever, which includes really up-to-date Google search data. So we don't think that this is nearly over, by the way. Those are two that make the press a lot. But for example, there's also AI software being developed for more targeted tasks like finance or human resources, and certainly Salesforce and customer engagement. So all of those are sort of niche, and then you've got your sort of big overarching models. But we don't necessarily see AI as a consumer-led revolution the way that this object we all carry around in our hands has been. Those technologies, as soon as a new food delivery app or something like that, or a language learning app popped up. It was right available on her screen. But AI is more likely to be a corporate-led technology where the real benefit is in finding business efficiencies and driving margins, both to automate and to reach customers through digital means more efficiently. So to that end, we think it's going to take time for companies to identify which aspects of this technology work for them and to be able to bring those online and improve their profitability. So this is probably the beginning of a multi-year cycle. The way we think about AI, or at least one way that people talk about it, is hardware, software, and data. And again, this is where you can think about an entire ecosystem. Yes, hardware is certainly your processors, right, like NVIDIA or like AMD, but AI is also generative AI in particular, which creates new knowledge, pictures, audio files, is much more data heavy than the conventional rules-based selection where we start with a big database and then the Netflix engine tells us what three things we want to watch. This is actually creating a lot more data. So one area to consider is something like data center REITs. And so that's a data storage argument. We thought 12, 18 months ago there could be overcapacity, but now the expectations for computer-generated data exceed that of human-generated data about 4 years from now. So big opportunity there. A second hardware area to consider is what I think of as the connective tissue between the physical world that we live in and the digital world that the computers understand. And this is where Internet of Things, or sensors and processors that are not fancy, they're actually low-energy processors, but we're talking about things like visual systems, pressure sensors in factories, temperature sensors in factories, light. All of those things are critical to sending conditions for machines to make decisions. So those are critical data inputs. And we don't want those, we don't want human intervention. We want to be able to create these connected worlds. So Internet of Things, another interesting area. Relating to all that is industrial automation, robotics, and the integration with artificial intelligence. We're talking about things like onshoring, nearshoring, increased global competition, more resilience in our supply chains, the CHIPS Act, $600 billion that's going to go into facilities. Well, that's going to help to bring more automation of high-tech materials onshore. So robotics and artificial intelligence, another. Then you can think about the pure software implementation. And so those are your algorithm makers, Microsoft, Google being among the most noticeable, but certainly not exclusive to that. There are a number of companies, smaller companies, that are developing interesting technologies. And then finally, by the way, one that's not talked about a lot is cloud computing, which I would argue that cloud computing in many ways becomes the distribution network for these artificial intelligence algorithms, right? Because if you think about big pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, big pharma, they don't do a lot of R&D. Little pharma do the R&D and get technologies close to market. Then they buy it because they have scale sales forces, existing customer base, and production capability. What do cloud companies already have? Existing distribution networks, client bases, and scale processing capabilities. So it's those companies that might not be just the Microsofts and the Google, but an entire other universe that are the ones that bring AI to the corporations and to the end clients. So that's what we mean when we talk about the AI ecosystem, that it's not just about one or two companies.
So along those themes, if I can get a few more themes, and that is infrastructure. Look, the federal government has passed a series of bills improving infrastructure. They've just ballooned the U.S. debt. We'll decide if that's out of control in a couple of years, but it's high. So is infrastructure a place that we want to put our money?
So I actually do really like infrastructure right now, partially because in the face of a potential economic slowdown, again, not a recession, but a potential slowdown, you've already got significant amounts of government money that are going to come online for infrastructure development. Now, to be clear, the way we think about infrastructure is a picks and shovels approach. So we're talking about industrial equipment makers, materials companies, construction and engineering firms. We're not talking about the old line stodgy infrastructure where somebody owns a port and gets a royalty, or owns a toll road or a toll bridge and maintains it and gets a royalty. But we're talking about the people that are actually building these things. And that $1.2 trillion in the U.S. infrastructure bill, that goes to infrastructure over these types of companies over the next 7 years. And on top of that, you mentioned multiple bills. The other one that I think is really relevant, I mentioned earlier, is the CHIPS Act. So $300 billion of public money that has $300 billion of matching private funds. So the infrastructure spend in the United States, I actually believe, is going to be 50% higher than what people thought, because semiconductor companies don't build semiconductor plants. Who does? Industrial equipment makers, materials companies, construction engineering firms, they build them. They don't operate them. Semiconductor companies do after they come online. But if you factor in that $1.8 trillion spent over 7 years, that's a significant revenue boost to many of these companies who are just starting to see, if we look at their releases to the investor community, their earnings releases, they're just starting to see the benefits of that money come into their financials, and even more importantly, come into their future guidance. And so as those companies see that money come online and they guide up, that could really be a tailwind for those companies. Not only that, but we're going into an environment, right? 2024 is an election year, Elliot. And what are the Democrats going to run on? What's their signature piece of legislation? It's infrastructure. And what are the Republicans going to say? Well, Trump wanted it first. So it was bipartisan when it passed. It's hard to imagine that either side is going to run against that. And part of it, again, is that CHIPS Act, which has to do with nearshoring and the competitive environment with China. Both parties are likely to try and out-hawk each other on the China story. So if anything, we might hear about more funds coming online to deal with increased competitiveness and increased resilience relative to global competition. So for a number of reasons, macro, fundamental, and geopolitical, infrastructure could be well positioned.
So I got two more to talk about. We've been talking about themes with Scott Helstein, with Global X, and we've come up with three great themes that we use in our portfolios: AI infrastructure and robotics, which is also BOTZ, isn't it?
Robotics. That's correct.
Yeah. There are two more I want to ask you about, and I appreciate you being on here. And that is that we're at war. We are in a war in Ukraine, helping them out. We're just not having troops on the ground. And we're in a war in the Middle East without troops on the ground. And we're going to put another $21 billion, give or take, into the Middle East. Defense technology. These are old companies that make amazing products in support of the United States military. They are amazing products. They're just staggeringly amazing if we understand what they are. But they're old. I mean, they're kind of, we put them in a value world because they give out 4 and 5 or 6% dividends. They're kind of boring. No one cares about McDonnell Douglas unless you're in that world. No one cares about Boeing except for, I want my plane to get me from San Francisco to Minneapolis. I don't really care about a Boeing bomber and so forth. Is the defense technology industry a place you can make money?
So it's something that I've tracked for a long time, obviously, with my history at West Point and serving as research director for the Army's Combating Terrorism Center. I do think it is an area, but investors have to understand some idiosyncrasies of it. These companies are very profitable. Elliot, to the point you made, they are some of the most impressive technology companies in the world. I went to the USA conference. It's the largest land power event in Washington, D.C. this past October. They pretty much take everything from tanks, rocket launchers, helicopters, drones, and they put them on display on two different floors. And you walk around and it is absolutely mind-boggling. Not only are these things state of the art, but many of them are now built with digital twins with hundreds of thousands of parts that exist in virtual reality so that when they have to be fixed, engineers can practice fixing them ahead of time and understand the machinery of it better. And you talk about putting autonomous capabilities online. There's more and more unmanned, not just aerial vehicles, but now land vehicles that are coming online as well, all of which can potentially be controlled in sort of a swarm technology using both human intervention and computer-supported algorithms. So we can think about some of these names as stodgy, but they are absolutely at the cutting edge of technology. And so given the fact that we have multiple conflicts, You did not mention, of course, China, and it's hard to see relations with the United States and China warming meaningfully, even though there is a little temporary thaw here, potentially, after Xi and Biden's visit together in San Francisco. But long term, the interests are not necessarily completely aligned. And so it's not just about Israel, it's not just about Ukraine. We want to be thinking about China as well. So the one caveat I would offer is that investors tend to presume because we go to war or because someone goes to war and we're supporting them, these companies are all of a sudden going to get a big revenue boost. But you got to remember, when you're producing 5, 10, whatever it might be, $4 billion high-tech jet planes a year, you're not all of a sudden doubling that number. So these are long-term contracts. They're very stable. When you are supplying missiles, yeah, we're going to have to renegotiate the missile contract and add some missiles. There's also limits, though, as to how much can be added. So these companies have been traditionally quite profitable. They are on the cutting edge, but investors shouldn't necessarily expect to see a 30, 40% pop. These are things that are going to continue to grow. They're great to have in your portfolio. And again, there's elements of it like cybersecurity, like defense contracting that are leaner, that are meaner, that will see more of a revenue support as conflicts heat up. And then there are these stable defense contractors on the leading edge.
So you mentioned China. And the fifth theme that I'm excited about is cybersecurity. But let me just do a quick follow-up for what you said, because I respect the fact that you've been at West Point. We're big fans of the U.S. military here, armed services. We're not somebody that fights you. And I kind of think we're at a de facto state of war today with China, certainly economic war, if not military war. But the Ukraine is a de facto state of war with Russia, and we're just practicing in Ukraine. Unfortunately, people die. And the same thing with the dome in Israel and the carriers that we have there, the Iron Dome. There are a lot of things that we're learning from, and the U.S. uses that. You mentioned also China and this incredible event that you go to in Washington, D.C. Aren't we giving away all of our secrets by doing that? I mean, these are China, Iran, spies. These are super smart people. Well, they're not dumb people saying, oh, we could beat China with our eyes closed because there, look what Russia just showed us, that they weren't prepared at all in Ukraine. They should have walked through it without a bullet being fired, but turned out very different than what they expected. China's a lot smarter than that with the biggest navy in the world now. They could lose more people in death in the army than we have in our entire armed services, and it would have no impact on society there. They have so many people available, so many men available that we don't have. Why are we doing that? Why are we giving our secrets away, or are we not? Am I just being naive?
I think you are absolutely correct. And multiple administrations have now talked about intellectual property theft with China in the hundreds of billions of dollars on an annual basis. So it's not naive to think it's going on. However, we have in the last couple of years implemented more restrictions in terms of technologies, for example, exporting a 14 nanometer chips being one of the prime ones. But there has been more focus around information sharing, technology sharing with China, obviously with Iran, that's been the case for years. And so it's pretty hard to argue that the United States does not have a technological advantage right now. And the concern, actually, what could push the Chinese to move sooner, I'm going to say could push the Chinese to move sooner, is that the more these technologies automate, and the more that we have automated submarines and we have automated unmanned vehicles, that nullifies the impact of the largest army in the world, right? And so that window of strategic advantage that China has could actually be closing because of technological development. And right now, the United States is the only nation in the world with global force projection capabilities. We are the only one that could put people and resources in a timely fashion anywhere in the world to get involved in conflict. So we have the only true broader, global blue water naval capability that we can extend everywhere in the globe simultaneously. So everybody else can pick and choose their spots. China's got a growing territorial navy that's really meant for one purpose, which is their territorial water. So it's a great question, and it's something that policymakers are acutely aware of, but I still think the United States maintains, even against the pressure, that we get in the espionage space still maintains the technological superiority.
We've been talking about AI themes. This whole show, Scott, has been dedicated to themes and thematic investing. If you've got questions, give us a ring at 925-314-8503 or Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T, at prosperityfinancialgroup.com. And all these Meet the Expert programs are on prosperityfinancialgroup.com. And we now are in the top 2% of all financial podcasts globally. Just amazing how this has grown in the last few years, thanks to some great speakers and like yourself and some super people like Chris in my office, who's our producer. The last theme, we've talked about AI infrastructure, robotics, defense technology, and now the last one that we are heavily invested in is cybersecurity. We've been there for quite some time. I almost feel like we need a bomb to go off in Chicago or Manhattan for all the cybersecurity stocks to skyrocket. But boy, that's real gloom and doom investing. I don't want to think like that. That's just terrible. But tell us about cybersecurity.
So if we are right that corporate investment trends are towards automation, digitalization, it's what all the polls say, and it's where companies are putting their dollars as of now. If we're right that this trend persists, what it means is that we are increasing virtual vulnerabilities across the entire economy. Cybersecurity becomes ubiquitous in that scenario. It's hard to say it's not already, but cybersecurity companies have grown their revenue significantly. They've converted, a lot of people haven't necessarily caught on to this, they've converted to what was a CapEx cycle, i.e. you bought a new box to protect you every 3 years, to a software service company, similar to a Microsoft and an Adobe, where you pay a monthly fee for your cybersecurity services or you're contracted to for a year, something along those lines. And it's delivered virtually. Some of it's still hardware, but much of it is software service, tends to have higher margins. What cybersecurity companies have failed to do for a very long time is that they weren't profitable. And so really, it was 2022 marked an important shift as interest rates were going up. Industries or themes, segments of the economy that were not profitable were really hit hard by the market. And that was essentially the market imposing capital discipline to say you're not allowed to grow at all costs anymore. You have to prove you're profitable. And cybersecurity companies only took a couple quarters to prove out their profitability. And since they've done that, they've either outperformed or more or less kept pace with the S&P 500. So I do think that the market around cyber and the conversation has shifted as they've proven that they can be profitable. I also think, for example, it's why Cisco just bought Splunk. You can sell an accretive deal to the market, a merger whereby your earnings are going to go up because you're buying scale. You can sell a dilutive merger to the market where your earnings are going to go down because you're overpaying, right? And you're paying more for growth. When you don't know which it is, it's hard to do. And so now that these companies are profitable, Cisco going in and buying one of the leading AI companies in sort of cybersecurity system monitoring makes a lot of sense. And cybersecurity is very segmented. There's lots of companies that do one or two things very, very well, like password protection or privileged information within a system or monitoring or connecting you to the cloud or connecting a core system to the end user through a secure tunnel. And it's highly likely that these things, we're going to see some consolidation in the space, which will drive even further efficiency than what we have today. So, from a geopolitical standpoint, right, the threats are going to exist. B, from a fundamental standpoint, companies are continuing to invest in these virtual technologies. And then C, from an actual industry standpoint, we could see some consolidation, but at a minimum, we think we'll continue to see profitability along with growth that's considerably sales growth that considerably beats the broader market like an S&P 500.
Well, this has just been great, Scott. There's a lot that we've talked about with the thematic investing in five different themes. It's what we do. If you've got more questions and you want to know how we build our portfolios, come reach out to us. Scott, you want to put some final words? I got a quick question for you. You were a professor for 6 years. You've got a PhD. You were at West Point. My son, who has two PhDs and a master's now, that he'd be the professor no one would want, because you'd be too tough as a grader. What were you like?
I was pretty tough, but West Point itself is a pretty tough academic environment. So it was good. I kind of fit right in. That said, I still have a great respect and a number of great relationships with my former cadets, one that I just got to see out on the West Coast recently. So I have nothing but respect for all the people who make the decision to go and serve our country and who have the discipline and the capability to make it through that environment.
Well, you've been great. Any final words you want to add to this?
Well, Elliot, we love talking about thematic investing at Global X. We're glad to be partnering with you and your team. And certainly, I encourage people to reach out to Elliot and the Prosperity Group because they are experts. They turn to us all the time, and it's a great collaboration. So we look forward to partnering in the future.
Scott, great having you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elliot.
Have a great day, everybody.